Blog Talk Radio.
Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back. This is the Blog Talk Radio show, The Reasonable Voices. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, here with our tech studio man, Bernard Henkins. And we have two very special guests today. We are, there's a big event coming up, Preservation Week, and we have the keynote speaker on. But let us talk about the man a little first that who is bringing him here, and that's Justin Serafin. Justin is, I met, as a matter of fact, connected to Monticello and the Kitchen Road Project and all things Monticello, but he is now, Justin Serafin is now the director of Preservations, Initiations, and Engagement for Preservation Virginia. And he has the support of the city of Charlottesville and American Heritage's Andrea Douglas with the newly renovated Jefferson School we know about downtown. And they are presenting Preservation Week with a special event Friday, May 3rd at Jefferson School at 6 p.m. That will feature keynote speaker Everett Fly. So first of all, a shout-out to Justin Serafin for making this possible. How are you today, Justin?
Just fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm great and glad to have you on. And to go on to introduce our VIP guest from San Antonio, Texas, Everett Fly will be in will be the speaker May 3rd for the event at Jefferson School for Preservation Week. And Everett Fly is a licensed landscape architect. He lives in San Antonio, Texas, and his work has included historic preservations in 15 states. He's currently restoring a 140-year-old African-American church in Texas. And in 1977, to go back a bit, he was the first Black American to earn the Master in Landscape Architecture from the Harvard Graduate School of Design. No small accomplishment. He is also a recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship that has allowed him to travel and research. And I guess, first of all, Everett Fly, how are you today, sir?
Fine, Marcello. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure and a really honor. I'm going to jump right in with a pretty heady question right away. Is what is your Black Settlements in America mythology?
Well, Marcello, when I started in architecture, I was required to take a number of history classes, as you might expect, Renaissance history, Gothic history, you name it. I had to take it as a degree requirement. And I would often ask my professors, could they tell me or give me any examples of architectural accomplishments or achievements by African Americans, and most of the professors couldn't give me an answer or a good guide to find some examples. So I would learn from them, from my professors, how they researched, and then when I had my opportunity to do the National Endowment for the Arts grant, I pretty much had to learn on my own how to find authentic documentation for African American communities, especially those from the 19th century. So I had to essentially develop kind of a humanities based methodology that is not just depending on the physical styles of architecture or the physical presence of architecture, but also to look at how and where African Americans lived, how they lived in a particular culture or society in different geographic locations. So pretty much wherever I would travel in the United States, I had to adapt to the culture of the region in order to find the buildings or the settlements or the structures where African Americans live. So that's a quick, in a nutshell, description is that it's interdisciplinary. It's an interdisciplinary methodology, not just looking at visual architectural history, but also cultural history, how and why people settled and how and why they built things the way they did, and the way they lived in those places and used those buildings. So that's a quick summary of how I go about it.
That's excellent. You know, I must confess, as you say it, it sounds like the most logical and rational approach, and yet I have to admit I've never thought of it that way. Thank you so much for taking time to answer that question. That's significant. That is so the right way to do it. I understand you've traveled across America and you've identified more than 800 African-American districts, neighborhoods, settlements, villages, and towns in the continental 48 states, and that's part of your preservation documentation mission, would you say?
Yes, that's certainly part of it. I actually started this as a, you mentioned in your introduction, as a graduate school research paper when I was studying at Harvard, and I think my first set of discoveries was maybe 30 or 40 settlements, and actually some of my classmates got interested. I was required to give like an oral final, so to speak. I had to give a presentation in front of my classmates, and some of them got interested, and so they began to, when they went back home, when we graduated and they went back home, they began to send me clippings of articles that would appear in newspapers and magazines in their areas or regions. And so then suddenly my collection grew from 40 to several hundred. And then other people over the years have sent me, done the same thing. They sent me clippings or accounts. I got one, for example, last week. One of my friends lives in Denver. Sent me an article about an African-American homestead that it's now located in downtown Denver. It was on the fringe of Denver, but now it's downtown and had been slated for demolition. And I wasn't aware of that at all, but my friend knew that I do this kind of work and of my interest and sent me an email, and so now I'm up to 1,201.
Oh my heavens! And when you you identify this site and begin your work, it gets a reprieve for life. Is that
sometimes it does? And in the case of the homestead in Denver, what I was able to do, my friend put me in touch with the Colorado Historical Society, and so. Through modern technology, I was able to send them off a quick email and explain if they couldn't physically save the structure, why it would be so important to document it, collect all the history they could, take all the photographs they could of this house, and do what we call, what architects call a set of measured drawings, where you actually measure the floor plan of the house, the size of the windows, the height from the floor to the ceiling, a detailed architectural documentation, so that that history, physical as well as cultural history, could be possibly used in educational programs and for people to learn in the future how these properties and how these residents contributed to the overall history of Denver, the overall history of Colorado, and of course, the United States. So the Colorado Historical Society was gracious enough to take my suggestion, and yesterday I received an article. They sent me a link for an article that verified that, in fact, they did take archaeologists, a photographer, some architects, and they measured and documented the house in a day.
Wonderful. Fantastic. You know, I it's not like I have a degree in history. I don't. But I have such a love of history that often in my past I've been a substitute teacher at a number of different levels of public education teaching history. And one of the things that upsets me the most is that the longer I live, the more I realize I was never teaching the whole history. I at best, I was teaching a fraction of it.
Oh, and, right.
You know, and when I talk with someone like you, and Justin, too, to be all fairness to Justin, I realize there is just so much that is not in the books and nobody talks about. And as you had an experience at a much higher level of education by asking professors, well, what can you tell me? And yet you couldn't get, well, happily you didn't get perhaps satisfactory answers because it's launched a whole new life mission for you, which we're all benefiting from.
Yes, I was fortunate enough. I'll quickly say one of the professors, so that I give proper credit, well, actually two of the professors at my professors at Harvard, one was John B. Jackson, and he was very interested in what I was doing. And Professor Jackson actually, I had to write the paper for the first paper for his class, and he was so interested that he challenged me to continue the research. And I thought it might just be kind of a passive challenge, but the semester after I finished his class, he called me in, and he said if I would continue the work that he would make arrangements for me to receive a rare books stack pass to the Harvard Library. And so that's where it really took off. Jackson wouldn't let me stop and gave me that rare books collection pass, and
wow.
That's where I really got things going. So there were a couple of professors like Jackson, and the chairman of the department, Charles Harris, was also very instrumental in helping me get the work started there.
Marvelous. It's a great story. It's just incredible. I know we are maybe shift just a little bit to Justin before we go to break. This is the 5th annual Preservation Week. That is the inciting moment, if you will, for this program, the Piedmont Region's 5th annual Preservation Week. Justin, this goes on from May 3rd to May 11th. Is that's correct?
That's right, May 3 to 11. And this is Preservation Piedmont's, as you mentioned, 5th annual week. We began Preservation Week really as a way to offer free programming, educational programming, here to the greater Charlottesville area, really to try to educate about historic preservation and some of the new ways that the movement is going. This week's theme of threatened sites and communities, of course, Everett is the ideal person to have in town to address these sorts of issues. And I would just like to say that it's Preservation Piedmont that does this. Serving City of Charlottesville and surrounding counties, so a regional preservation group. You did mention I'm with Preservation Virginia and formerly of Monticello. It's really wonderful, the intersection of and Everett and I hadn't really talked about it before, but the intersection of some of my previous work with his methodology.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I had thought of that as he was answering his question, remembering how you took me through Monticello and talked pretty much about the same kinds of discoveries over there that you guys were going to, through computer enhancement, give a new life to. So did you get that too as Everett was talking to us?
I did. And when we're talking about resources that are essentially African American, former homesteads, cemeteries, things like this. And especially as some of my past work at Monticello, a lot of these materials are no longer. So Everett's mentioned the site in Denver that's kind of a part of what's now downtown. In more rural areas, a lot of structures don't exist, and it sort of brought to mind some of the other pieces that we really had to use at Monticello, which was, of course, looking at the archaeological record. And I wonder sort of to what degree Everett ever deals with the oral history piece of things, and does that inform his methodology at all?
Well, we're going to get into that and what he has to say or plans to say on May 3rd about the threatened sites and communities right after this break, if we could. Everyone, stay with us. This is a magnificent historical discussion with Justin Serafin, Director of Preservations and Initiations and Engagement of Preservation Virginia, as we enter soon the Piedmont region's 5th Annual Preservation Week, and our special guest, licensed landscape architect, Everett Fly. We will be right back right after this break.
And now, another film rental discovery. Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. There are heroes and villains in all forms of storytelling. They drive the story forward and give the audience someone compelling to root for. But what if the hero and the villain are the same person? Can you still be a hero if your path to get there wasn't the most honorable? This is the central question of David Gordon Green's George Washington. In a rural North Carolina town, a group of kids enjoy their summer. They swim, hang out, try to steal cars, and fall in and out of love. The odd one out is George, a boy whose skull never fully hardened after he was born. When George accidentally kills another member of the group, the summer turns into something more somber and uncertain. No longer innocent and carefree, the boys hide the body and attempt to move on with their lives. However, George's rescue of a drowning boy thrusts him into the limelight in the role of local hero, a responsibility with which he has difficulty coming to grips. This film is nothing short of stunning. Beautiful cinematography and the sharp acting of the town's denizens combine to form a poetic exploration of right and wrong. Even more powerfully, it's a stark reminder of that last idyllic summer before adulthood took hold. George Washington. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
And welcome back. This is the Reasonable Voices, Blog Talk Radio, with special historic guests today, preserving all of American history, one property, one site at a time, one threatened site and threatened community. We here in Charlottesville can only have to think of Vinegar Hill, as well as certainly other historical places where the communities that have been lost, absorbed, covered over, plowed over. But let's get back to something Justin was suggesting I'd like to ask Everett Fly about, and that's oral history, and as combined with or connected to what Everett Fly was talking about earlier, and that is not just rediscovering and preserving the buildings, but the cultural history. How does oral history and cultural history marry to help you accomplish your goal of historic preservation, Everett?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because in the African American culture, oral tradition and oral history are essential. Quickly, for example, I grew up visiting with my and having to spend summers with my grandparents in East Texas, and both of them had just a little bit of schooling, maybe to the fifth or sixth grade, but they knew every hill and valley within 40 miles of their home site, and my granddad would tell all kinds of stories and all kinds of directions how to get to this place or that, following natural landmarks like follow the creek or look for the big oak tree, and so that left an impression on me. And when I began to work on the black settlements history, I found that it carried over. It essentially, I would not be able to do what I do without oral history. I had one case, for example, in some years back in Rockville, Maryland, and there was a small enclave of African-American residents left in Rockville, and they couldn't, the local historians couldn't figure out why the houses were, of the black residents, were turned or oriented the way they were. So when I had a chance to go, one of the first things I asked for was an opportunity to sit down with the residents and ask them questions about things like that. And in short order, they told me or explained to me that the roads, the modern roads that existed there in Rockville were not the original roads. And so they had actually built these houses in the 19th century to be oriented towards the old roads, because they explained that what you wanted to be able to do in that rural area is if someone was approaching your house, you wanted to be able to see them approaching. So you turned your face or your front to the old road, but when the new roads came in, they changed the transportation grid and the orientation was different, but that's how we got the answer, was through that oral history of them explaining, and then it made perfect sense.
Oh, my God. That is something. Tell me, it's just so fascinating to hear this. I'm wondering if you might give us, dare I ask, for a little preview of what you're going to be talking about on Friday, May 3rd at the Jefferson School at 6 p.m.?
Sure, I can do that without giving away the talk. Of course, one of the main things I want to do is provoke thought, get the audience to think about how they approach and why they approach historic preservation, a little bit differently. They don't have to agree with me, but if they just start thinking and saying what if, I think we'll all be better off than. If we stay stuck with one perspective or one train of thought, and then of course I have had such wonderful experiences with finding documents and records and things like that people didn't believe existed for these African American settlements and communities. I'm going to share some examples of real authentic documentation that I've been able to find, some case studies, and how just finding the documentation adds to the integrity and the continuity of the whole historical story. It's not just a matter, I don't do my work simply as a matter of nostalgia. I do it as a professional architect and a professional landscape architect so that I can, whatever communities I work with, I can help them move to some action, not just collecting the history, but using that history for good planning decisions or good education decisions or programs that help education and physical planning and development and that kind of thing. So I've got a couple of good case studies that address that. And as we talked about earlier, all through my talk next week, I'll be talking about the interrelated nature of America and our history and our democracy and our culture, how interrelated different ethnic, social, political, economic, intellectual groups are, and how important it is to tell that whole story as opposed to keeping them separated and pulled apart and isolated.
Yes, the connection. And once we realize there is a connection, that bridge is a marvelous journey to travel back and forth until they become one. I never tire of this, even though, as I said, as a history teacher, such as I've been, it's very disappointing to discover again and again that I only told part of the story because that's all I knew. Everett Fly, it has been just exceptional listening to you today, and I encourage everyone to please tweet about and attend
as much of Preservation Week as you can, but especially Friday, May 3rd, 6 p.m. at the Jefferson School, to hear Everett Fly tell you the whole story. I'm wondering if you can jump in for a moment to Justin Serafin, who's also with us today. There are other highlights for Preservation Week in addition. I'm thinking, frankly, one thing that comes to mind is the recent rediscovery, as though they didn't know it was there, of the Black Cemetery that VDOT discovered. And when we were trying to figure out where we're going to put the Western Bypass, are there things like that going to be included, cemetery conservation, any panel discussions? Justin, give us a little broader picture beyond May 3rd, if you would.
Sure. Well, certainly Everett's talk we're really seeing as sort of introducing this topic on kind of a national level, but really speaking to some of the issues that here in the historic preservation community here in Greater Charlottesville that we're facing, especially some of the sites that Preservation Piedmont in the last couple of years has come upon or sort of been invited to either document or advocate for these types of things. So there will be a panel of wonderful scholars talking about identifying and conservation of African-American cemetery resources, talking a bit about how those should be commemorated, and really looking at the issue of how to recognize these resources sort of in the face of transportation projects, expansion, development, these types of things. It's something that we're coming up against again and again here regionally, but also statewide. So it's really a current topic. Preservation Piedmont, we came by the theme really by doing some of the work that Everett described a bit earlier in the show, and that was discovering these, I'll call them just sort of unknown gems, these sites of African-American historical significance, some here in the city, some in the county, Albemarle County, a couple of which have since been demolished, but certainly we advocated for their preservation and certainly fully documented them before they were lost for that historical record. And they're from little known communities and little known sites here in the area, things like the Kellytown area in Charlottesville, a house that was lost, an African-American church a bit north, Pleasant Grove Baptist Church. You might know it, the one that was at the very end of the Charlottesville-Albemarle Airport runway, since been demolished. And so the idea of lost and threatened communities really came about as we were working on these sites. We were starting to notice a real connection, or unfortunately a trend, whereby we're discovering these sites and there's very little awareness for them. And so then with more recent activity as far as road projects here in Charlottesville, it's just an incredibly...
I'm sorry, Justin, to cut you off.
No.
Before we go, we're just running out of time. I just wanted to thank again Mandy Burbage, the president of Preservation Piedmont, and Andrea Douglas, American Heritage Center at the Jefferson School, where Everett Fly will be speaking this coming Friday, a week, May 3rd at 6 p.m. And Everett, do you have any last couple of words for us about your stay here and what you're going to be talking about? And I just want to say thank you so very much for being on the show, and you too, Justin. But any final word from you, Everett?
Well, again, thank you, Martello, for having me. And I'm looking forward to learning as much from Charlottesville as sharing my experiences. So it'll be a two-way experience, I assure you.
Thank you so much, both of you, Justin Serafin and Everett Fly, for being on The Reasonable Voices this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. So long for now.